Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Veteran astronauts find new missions in writing. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield famously filmed a music video from orbit, performing David Bowie's Space Oddity on the International Space Station. Well, since his spacefaring days, Hadfield has taken on a new creative mission, fiction writing. We'll catch up with Hadfield about his new journey, writing crime thrillers. Then, veteran NASA astronaut Tom Jones's new book, Space Shuttle Stories, chronicles the decades-long space shuttle program with interviews from participants of those more than 100 missions. We'll speak with Jones about his work as a historian, preserving the history of the program. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The Apollo Murders is a speculative science fiction thriller penned by veteran Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. It has spurred a follow-up book, television series, and is just one of a handful of writing projects from the mustached space flyer, pilot, and engineer. Hadfield's newest book is The Defector, a follow-up to The Apollo Murders. He joins us now to talk about his new adventures in writing and how his experience as a space oddity and engineer helped him navigate this new profession. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be speaking with you again.
Yeah, and the last time we had you on, your book, The Darkest Dark, was out. Since then, there have been plenty of other books. You've been quite a prolific writer. Tell me a bit about your journey from astronaut to writer.
Well, I'm still very much an astronaut, working with space companies, director of several companies, technology incubator, super busy on the technical side. But it's really great to be able to share the experience through writing as well. Darkest Dark, the one you mentioned, that was a children's book. And, you know, it's easy to write a lousy children's book. It's hard to write a good one. And we worked really hard. And it was the fourth children's book I wrote, I think, but the only one we published. And it's done great. And I just love the anecdotal stories from all around the world of the kids that are understanding space flight and how not to be afraid. And so I love the idea of trying to share ideas through writing. And now writing fiction with the Apollo Murders series, and most recently, the book that just came out two or three months ago, The Defector. It's a great, you know, personal challenge to write thriller fiction, but it's also having terrific success. And it's a really fun way to let people in on the nitty gritty of what space flight and being a combat fighter pilot and test pilot is really like.
I have to say, every kid that I know in my life got a copy of The Darkest Dark after I got a copy from you, and they have enjoyed it very much. So thank you for that. But let's talk about, you mentioned that there is a challenge in writing thriller fiction. Had you always had this interest in writing, Chris, or is this something that relatively new for you?
You know, where did your dreams come from when you think about it? A lot of it came from media of some sort, right? You went and saw a movie, or you read a story, or somebody read a story to you, or you watched a video or something. Because in your normal mundane day-to-day life, you know, growing up, going to school, whatever, on the ball team, you don't think about the universe and superheroes and exploring stars and stuff nearly as much. But that comes to you through fiction or through media. And for me, some of those early comic books and then movies and TV shows and science fiction books, they were absolutely critical in giving me the idea that maybe some of this stuff could actually happen in my life, that this sort of thing wasn't just a fantasy, but this is a real life part of what goes on. And so to be able to link those together, I've always found really important as a reader and a consumer. And now at this stage of life, where I've had a lot of those experiences, it's just as much fun to try and be someone who's providing those ideas, whether it's, you know, playing guitar in a space station or making TV series, or now writing nonfiction and thriller fiction. And what I love the most is a really good gripping thriller fiction book, you know, where I'm like sitting somewhere boring, but I'm having this huge adventure in my head because of what's written on the page that nobody around me is having. And I've always loved that type of escapism that a book can give you. And when it's tied to real events and real history and you learn stuff and you feel like you're emerged from some amazing experience when you turn the last page, that's the type of book I wanted to be able to write. And that's the task I gave myself. And it's great to see the huge success that The Apollo Murders has had and now The Defector is having. And it's, you know, it's inspired me to start working on the third book in the series.
I want to talk about those books in a minute. But first, what is your approach to writing? You know, as a writer myself, I approach things, you know, my way. With your background as an engineer, how do you bring in some of that to the way that you write? Like, I'm assuming that your plots are like engineering diagrams. You know, is that the way that you approach writing?
When I first went to space, we were going to help build a Russian space station, Mir, and we launched without a flight plan, if you can believe it, because things were changing so rapidly and there were so many unknowns that we had a big skill set. But we did not have a plot yet. Even though we were nothing but a bunch of engineers and scientists. And I think it's sort of like that, in that what you got to do is gather all of the threads of possibility and then do a whole bunch of research so that you've got the capability to put it all together when you have to. But then you've just got to start writing. That's what I've learned. And I'm sure you know the same thing. And when you start writing fiction, you're going to put yourself into corners immediately where now, what would my characters do next? And shoot, now I got to look, I didn't even know they'd do that, but that's obviously what those people would do next. And now I've got to solve all that. And so no, what I have as someone with my background is I have the general arc and I've got enough loose threads that I'm pretty sure I can weave it all together. I've got the major signposts of history of the period that I'm setting the book in. And then there's an enormous amount of research of digging out stories and digging out details. And then when I start writing, now it's weaving it all together and turning it into something that is factually true, but also, you know, a gripping page turner if I can make it happen. So that's the process. And I try and write about 1,000 words on my writing days, do it in the morning because by the afternoon, my brain is full. And I'm a constant back editor. Like I read what I wrote the last couple of days and then I, you know, I'll probably go change some stuff there. And then I start writing and I'll write full of blurb and then I go back and read it and fix some stuff. So it's a very iterative process. But that's how the five books have gotten written so far. And that's the process I'm going through on the sixth right now.
Yeah. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Right. It seems to be working quite well. So let's talk about the success with Apollo Murders and the new book, the Defector. Where did this idea come from? I hope it's not something that happened in space to you personally.
What I did when I thought, okay, I'm going to try and write thriller fiction is I went back and reread what I think is the really good thriller fiction, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and go back and read Robert Ludlum and Ken Follett and James Bond and John D. MacDonald with the Travis McGee series and Dick Francis with his whole series and Jonathan Kellerman and Lee Child. Read all those, you know, but read them like an engineer would read them. How did they choose words? How did they attribute sentences? How long were their paragraphs? How did they reveal the plot? Like, it's a real structural, clinical thing to learn how to do that. And so for me, trying to learn the skill was a really important part of tasking myself with putting it together. And then, of course, everybody needs a good editor. I read Stephen King's book on writing, and it was hugely permission-giving because he included a big blurb of his raw writing, and it was terrible. Like, it was bad sentence structure, poor thought processes, but the raw materials were there. And it just demonstrated how the creative spark and the raw work needs to be done. But then you need a good editor to come in and say, hey, you know, we don't need all these words and you should trim this. Just like a movie director and a film editor have an absolutely necessary relationship. You need that too. So yeah, I'm learning as I go, try and get more efficient at it. So it's not a matter of not broke, don't fix it. It's a matter of something that's working, keep trying to fine tune it.
So tell us about the new book, The Defector. Give us a quick elevator pitch as to what the synopsis is and the intrigue this book promises to give.
Sure. It's the fall of 1973, a height of the Cold War, the end of the Apollo era, and topically right now, conflict in the Middle East, and a Soviet fighter, the fastest, highest flying fighter ever built, suddenly defects into Israel. And Israel trades it with the United States in order to support what's going on. And it ends up out in the desert in Nevada, where all of the confiscated Soviet fighters were at the time, at a place called Area 51. And not only does the fighter come in there, but the pilot, who's a Soviet test pilot, is brought out there to help teach the U.S. military what to do with this airplane. But the real crux of the story is the interplay between my protagonist, Kaz Zemeckis, who's also a test pilot and fighter pilot, and what the real purpose of that airplane defecting and what the real point of trying to get to Nevada was. That's the crux of The Defector. And it leads to the big, super heavy action scene at the end of great conflict, and hopefully setting the stage for the third book in the series.
Chris, most people will remember you from the time you created a music video from the International Space Station, Space Oddity. It was brilliant. It was wonderful. It was inspiring. So it goes as no surprise that you are getting into TV as well. Tell me a bit about how you're now going from writing books to getting into television.
Well, I've done several series, National Geographic and BBC and things like that. But when Sylvester Stallone and his wife, Jennifer, read The Apollo Murders, they loved it. And I was already working with a production house in the UK called Altitude. But Sly Stallone, he actually called me one day and said he'd pitched my book to Amazon without even asking me. And so now his production house, which he calls Balboa Productions, naturally, and the production house in the UK, they've signed together and they are working now on bringing the Apollo Murders to be a television series. And so writing continuing books in that series makes sense. I'm super excited. I'm now an executive producer. I don't even know what that is, but I'll figure it out. I figured out how to command a space station. We'll figure this out. But it's super exciting. Who'd have thought that this might be possible? But fundamentally for me, it's another whole way to really richly share the amazing experience of flying in space. And yeah, a lot, you know, everything that's in these books is credible, but fortunately, those weren't things that happened to me. But I think that tenuous link between amazing possibility and the reality of stuff that actually happens, that's where the whole crux of these books and the TV series, that's the whole secret sauce of them.
And Chris, in the minute we have left here, I am reminded in this conversation of something you told me when we talked about The Darkest Dark, and it's not to be afraid, to take risks. And it seems like that has what has been your success in this next portion of your career. Is that the message that you want to tell people out there, is to just do, to just try, to go for it?
Well, you've got to take care of business. You've got to honor all your obligations. You need to take care of self, family, friends, you know, all your day-to-day stuff. But there's some freestyle time every day. And life is a daring adventure or nothing. You get one. 30,000 days. What are you going to do with those days? How far are you going to try and push your own capabilities? What, when you look back at the end of the month or the year or the decade, what are you going to be proudest of? What are you going to regret not doing? To me, I think you should constantly be challenging yourself to grow and improve your own skill set and try stuff you've never tried before. My wife is doing her fifth university degree right now. And to me, that's the very essence of a life well lived.
We're speaking with Chris Hadfield, pilot, engineer, astronaut, writer, and now executive producer, whatever that means. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, good to talk with you. Be well.
Still to come, a veteran NASA astronaut's efforts to preserve the history of the space shuttle program.
Building the International Space Station and operating it for the last 20 years was enabled by the skills of the shuttle team. And when we go back to the moon in just the next few years and then take on the challenges of going way off into the deep space destinations like the asteroids and Mars, it's going to be remembering these lessons from the shuttle, among other lessons that we'll capture, that will prevent us from these accidents that we've experienced during the shuttle's career, we can prevent those from happening if we remember these lessons. So I want people to walk away with the human experience of the joys of flying on the shuttle. We thought we were the luckiest people on the planet to fly the shuttle. And then to remember the tragedies that occurred and to apply those to our future planning and exploration of space, I think is what people will take away.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You are listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Veteran NASA astronaut Tom Jones spent around 53 days in space on four space shuttle missions. He's the author of four books. His latest is Space Shuttle Stories, first-hand astronaut accounts from all 135 missions. Jones collected this definitive oral history of the space shuttle program through interviews with 133 of his astronaut colleagues. He spoke with Are We There Yet's producer, Marion Summerall, about the process of chronicling decades of space shuttle missions.
Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marion.
So let's talk about what inspired Space Shuttle Stories. I mean, this has never really been done before so thoroughly. So what was kind of your inspiration?
The shuttle flew for 30 years until 2011. And I was part of that story. I flew four times on the space shuttle and I knew many astronauts. I flew with 20 of them in space. And when I saw the shuttle retire in 2011, I thought that there's a lot of history there that hasn't been captured yet. There are several good technical histories about the shuttle's design and development, testing, and flight career. And those accomplishments are well documented by NASA and some authors, including Dennis Jenkins, who's done an extraordinary job on that technical history. But the human story wasn't there. There were many individual astronaut memoirs, you know, a dozen probably or more. I've written one myself. However, even as an astronaut, I didn't get the chance to talk to everybody who flew the shuttle, nor get to talk to everybody who flew on one of those 135 missions. I wanted to get those stories. I wanted to get them in my head, but I also wanted to share them with people because I think the lessons learned on the space shuttle have taught us how to build and operate the International Space Station. And those lessons learned are going to help us get to the moon again and then go on to Mars. And so I could contribute to that effort, I thought, by capturing those vital lessons learned from the flyers on the space shuttle.
And the space shuttle has been used, like you said, for 30 years, and you were trying to get all of these interviews. So what was the process in getting, your total was 133 interviews, correct?
Right. There were about 355 people who flew on the space shuttle. And I realized in 2020, when I was thinking about this project, that it would be impossible for me to interview 350 plus people. But the idea of getting one person from every one of the 135 missions seemed doable. And then the pandemic hit. We had a lot of time on our hands where we were restricted to cameras and audio interviews. And so I thought, well, if I can just call up one person from each of those 135 flights, I might be able to chew that challenge to bite by bite, work it down to a doable project. So I was able to start with STS-1, Space Transportation System 1, the very first mission of Columbia in 1981. And I worked my way chronologically for the most part through all those 130 plus interviews. There were challenges because we lost two shuttle crews in 1986 and in 2003. And so I had to figure out a way to deal with those missing crew members and get their stories as well. But it was a doable job. And it took me 2.5 years to complete all the interviews. And there was another year of editing the transcripts and getting it all whipped into book form.
So, Tom, were you able to find an astronaut easily from each one of the space shuttle missions? I mean, that must have been really hard to track everyone down in that process as well.
Well, the big challenge, of course, were the two lost shuttle crews from Challenger and Columbia. And that's 14 astronauts I wasn't able to talk to. Fortunately, a lot of them had left interviews behind with the press and the media back in the 80s and in the 2000s. And NASA had a lot of video material available for me as well. So I was able to dive into that and get some snippets of each of the voices of those crew members and do them justice, I think, for their very important contributions to space exploration. But over 30 years, as you might expect, a lot of astronauts have moved on. to other careers, and in some cases, they've left us. And so I was really worried that I would wind up looking at one of the early shuttle missions, for example, where there were only two crew members aboard or four, and they might all have left us. I was fortunate enough by starting early on those missions in my interview process to find at least one from each one. There was one case where Ken Mattingly, who just passed away in 2023, he was an Apollo explorer, but he was also a space shuttle commander. And he was at the age where he could no longer do interviews in his 90s. And along with his co-pilot, who had passed away, they were the only voices available. So fortunately, NASA had gotten to him about 20 years ago and done an oral history interview. And so Ken Mattingly's long conversation about his experiences on the shuttle was preserved by the Johnson Space Center. And that's how I was able to capture Ken Mattingly's voice. I think one of the most moving was Laura Clark's interview. Now, Laura was one of the crew members lost on the shuttle Columbia, and she was a colleague of mine. We worked together in planning the space station, and here she was in orbit on her first trip, and her crew was lost on February 1st, 2003, when Columbia broke up on reentry. There are seven crew members, and they were all good friends of mine, and I decided that I could obviously have a snippet of some interview portion that each of the seven did that I could publish, but I found an email from Laura Clark, and she was on her first mission, and she'd sent an email back in the closing days of the flight to her friends and family on Earth. And it so encapsulated the exhilaration and the satisfaction that they were having with their successful science mission and the camaraderie that they were experiencing on the shuttle Columbia and the view out the window and just the day-to-day life aboard the shuttle that I thought this would stand for all seven of them. So Laurel's, one of her final emails home was the way that I captured the whole spirit of that crew. And her letter home is very heartfelt, and it's so exuberant that I thought that was the way to capture the story of the STS-107 crew, and it's probably the most moving of all the ones that I did.
How long did it take you from when you thought of this idea to now its publication? We talked a little bit about the interviews, you know, that were taking 2 years, but from when you had the idea to now, you know, can you just kind of run through the process and how long did that kind of take?
Early 2020, January, I was down in Florida speaking at the Kennedy Space Center and working down there, and I had dinner with my friend Dennis Jenkins, who's a 30-year experienced shuttle engineer. And he's the one who's written these great histories about the technical performance of the shuttle and its development. So I said, you know, Dennis, I've got this project in mind where I want to get some shuttle stories together. And I said, I like your authenticity and your accuracy and the technical detail, but I want to capture the human story for the book. And so I said, if you don't mind, I'll borrow the idea that you have a book with each one of the missions in turn, telling the story of that mission in a thumbnail fashion. But then I want one page of the two-page spread for each of those missions to capture an astronaut story. I said, what do you think of that idea? He goes, yeah, nobody's ever done that before. To be fair, and to give credit to NASA, they have an oral history program at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, where they've interviewed a number of astronauts about their shuttle experiences, but by no means all, by no means not even a majority. So I had a free field then to go out and talk to my crewmates and colleagues and find out what their experiences were. And the remarkable thing was, in the 2.5 years it took me to do that, was that I realized very early on, I'd never heard any of these stories before, because I was working and training so hard on my own flights for 11 years that, yeah, I knew my crewmates' stories. We had plenty of time together, but I never heard the guy who flew 4 years before me or 10 years before me or 5 years after I left NASA. I'd never heard those personal stories before. So the pleasure of having a Zoom call, talk for an hour or 45 minutes or so with one of my crewmates, and then just hear it all spill out, that was really a privilege to sit down and have that session with each one of my colleagues. And then I hope I've done justice by, you know, editing their interviews and getting it on the page. I hope I've done justice to what they felt in conveying those experiences. I think it comes across well.
And some of the interviews you did, you didn't know maybe some people previous, right, of the 133, but connecting with all these people on a different level must have been also really exciting to you too, because not only does it bring your stories and your experience back, but you get to kind of relate to a specific group of people in a completely different way, right?
You know, my shuttle colleagues, I probably met all of them at one time or another at astronaut reunions, or we worked in the astronaut office rubbing shoulders together, but, you know, just didn't have a chance to fly together. But what this interview process gave me a chance to do was to get to know their experiences in really personal, emotional detail. And so it's the equivalent of just sitting at a bar and having a beer together and just having a casual chat and hearing, hey, what was your favorite space experience story that you can tell me? And that's what I got out of these interviews. And people were very open and, you know, gave me lots of detail and a lot of emotion, their fears, their anxieties, their hopes, their exhilaration, sense of satisfaction all came across. So it was really a privilege to talk to especially some of the earlier early shuttle astronauts like Dick Truly. He was on the second shuttle mission, and he was later the administrator of NASA. So yeah, I'd met him before, shaken hands, but he was my boss about eight layers higher than me back when I knew him at NASA. Here I am getting a personal chance to talk with him about his experiences flying on that second shuttle mission. And so those were really experiences I'd never dreamed of having with all of these people close up and personal.
Kind of the big question is, what do you hope people gain from reading this book? I mean, your target audience, and when somebody opens it and starts reading the stories and seeing the amazing photography that's in it as well, what do you hope they walk away with?
Well, 30 years, it's hard to get your head around that. But this book, I think, brings it to a level where you can dive in anywhere and find out how we learn to do the things that we do well in space. It's all a team effort. As I mentioned earlier, you can't do this job by yourself, and you wouldn't want to, actually. And so to have all the resources of your teammates in your spacecraft there with you, the talents of the people in mission control, the flight controllers, the launch team that got your ship off the ground in Florida and then helped get them back home and get the shuttle ready again. All of those efforts were instrumental in teaching us the things that we know how to do in space today. So building the International Space Station and operating it for the last 20 years was enabled by the skills of the shuttle team. And when we go back to the moon in just the next few years and then take on the challenges of going way off into the deep space destinations like the asteroids and Mars, it's going to be remembering these lessons from the shuttle, among other lessons that we'll have captured, that will prevent us from these accidents that we've experienced during the shuttle's career. We can prevent those from happening if we remember these lessons. So I want people to walk away with the human experience of the joys of flying on the shuttle. We thought we were the luckiest people on the planet to fly the shuttle. And then to remember the tragedies that occurred and to apply those to our future planning and exploration of space, I think is what people will take away.
It's incredible to think 30 years. And what do you think is the space shuttle's legacy in these 30 years and maybe in the future as well? I know we touched a little bit on it, but in your own words, you know, what would be the space shuttle's legacy?
The shuttle was a work and a science platform as well as a truck. And so we shifted over from the heroic expeditions of Apollo, the six times that we landed on the moon in the 60s and 70s, to going to work in low Earth orbit and using the resources that are out there, the free fall environment, weightlessness, the solar energy that's there, the pure vacuum that's available. So we could start to do laboratory research. We could launch great observatories like the Hubble into orbit. We could assemble the International Space Station. We visited the Russian Mir space station 9 times with the shuttle. So all of these operations were enabled by the space shuttle's versatility and flexibility. You know, it started out as just a satellite launcher to just dump commercial satellites into space and a few science ones as well. But after the Challenger accident, it shifted over to a science platform. And all of its satellite launches were planetary probes and Earth observation satellites. It carried instruments to observe the planet, carried mini laboratories to pave the way for the space station. So the shuttle's legacy is that it made the transition from the crash programs of the space race into the era now in the 21st century where we use the resources of space. We have the commercial space sector partnering with NASA, and now we're making use of this environment rather than just taking our first tentative steps into it. And the shuttle was not a perfect ship. It was fragile, it was expensive, but over 30 years, it did teach us the way to build better ships of the future.
Well, Tom, this was great. And thank you so much for your time today. And the book, Space Shuttle Stories, is available now. And Tom, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks. I hope everybody will enjoy the book. I sure enjoyed writing it.
That was Tom Jones, veteran NASA astronaut and author of the new book, Space Shuttle Stories, speaking with Are We There Yet's producer, Marion Summerall. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got more space coverage online, visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.